This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Colleges have become more multicultural. Along with this new diversity has come a rise in open expressions of racism. Many colleges are trying to combat hatred with language codes, codes that prohibit students from intimidating or harassing other students with epithets and obscenities directed at race, sexual preference, religion, or ethnic group. But these language codes are very controversial. Some civil liberties groups say the codes violate a student's right to freedom of speech. On today's Fresh Air, we'll be hearing from people on both sides of the issue. The University of Wisconsin instituted a language code in 1989. It's currently being challenged by the Wisconsin ACLU. Pat Hodelick is the senior legal counsel for the University of Wisconsin. I asked her why the university decided it needed a language code.
First of all, we had had a number of incidents of racist conduct going on our campuses, and these were fairly highly publicized locally, and they were occurring at the same time that our Board of Regents and universities were embarking on some major programs to improve recruitment and retention of minorities. So it was felt that having some sort of discriminatory harassment rule in place would help improve the environment on campus for minorities and thus help with these other efforts at recruiting and retaining minorities.
What type of language does the code restrict?
Well, it restricts actually more than language. You need to establish a number of things to have prohibited conduct under our rule. You need to have, first of all, the utterance of a discriminatory epithet, and then it has to be directed at an individual, and it has to intentionally demean that person on the basis of race or sex or another protected characteristic. And it also has to intentionally create a hostile environment for education or university work.
So you can't just defame a whole ethnic group. You'd have to call, you'd have to use an epithet against one person in particular.
That's right.
Let me read an excerpt of the university's administrative code. A student would be in violation of the language code if he or she intentionally made demeaning remarks to an individual based on that person's ethnicity, such as name-calling, racial slurs, or, quote, jokes. Ethnic jokes would be punishable?
Well, they would be if they met the other requirements of the rule in that they were directed at somebody with an intention to make that person suffer a hostile environment and be demeaned. In actual practice, with the rule in place for about a year and a half now, we haven't had a case where a joke was involved.
Does that, though, run the risk of prohibiting any politically incorrect humor on campus?
I don't think so, primarily because it's not just a matter of telling a joke to a group of people. It has to be a joke told to a protected group member with the intent to demean that person on the basis of his or her group status and so on.
How many times have you actually had to use the language code?
We have had, I believe, 32 complaints filed of violations of the provision you're referring to. And discipline has only been imposed, I believe, in 10 of those.
Can you give us a sense of the instances in which discipline was imposed?
Well, in perhaps the most serious case, a student was suspended in connection with an incident where he attempted to show false identification to enter a residence hall, and the student working at the desk and the hall director were both members of minority groups. And when they questioned him about the identification, he responded by calling them various racist names, and eventually an altercation erupted in which he assaulted one of the employees. So he was suspended for a violation of the regulation concerning discriminatory harassment, as well as for his assaultive conduct and presenting false ID. In virtually every instance, there's been some use of epithets, and In most of the instances, the disciplinary action has occurred not only as the result of the use of epithets, but because there's been some other sort of assaultive conduct or other misconduct involved as well.
I'm wondering if the majority of circumstances where the language code has come into play, where if there's also been assaults involved with that, why do you feel like you need the language code? Because an assault is kind of much more clear-cut, you know what I mean, than language, which is always subjective and which is usually protected by the First Amendment.
Well, when we were developing the code, we were relying on a number of reports of situations where the conduct was purely verbal and didn't involve assaults. Now, since we've had the code in place, it has become apparent that many of these situations do involve assaultive behavior in fact. But I think that we still need something to deal with those instances where the conduct is verbal conduct that is harmful.
Pat Hodulik is senior legal counsel for the University of Wisconsin. Nat Hentoff is a longtime advocate of First Amendment rights. He has a weekly column in the Village Voice on First Amendment issues. He recently wrote a series on the debate over university language codes. He told me he objects to restricting language on campus because he opposes restricting language anywhere.
If there is a basic, fundamental engine that makes this peculiar experiment, constitutional democracy, I'm quoting Jefferson, work, it's that we all have a right to free speech, no matter how offensive. And that very much includes at a college campus.
But what about minorities or women on college campuses who are being harassed because of things that are being said to them?
You know, I've been to at least a dozen college campuses in the last 6 or 7 months. With very few exceptions, the strongest, most direct, most forthright groups are the black groups, the African-American groups, and the women's groups. To talk about protecting them is to patronize them. To indicate, well, you are so fragile, so weak, that you can't deal with this speech by more and better speech of your own.
What's an example of a code and one of its uses that you're most disturbed by?
Well, at the core of practically every one of these speech codes, there is the phrase, and if you create an intimidating, hostile learning environment, then you will be punished. No further explanation, just as there is no further explanation on most of these and any of these codes for the phrase, if you intend to stigmatize, if you intend to insult. I mean, you think about it. Let's take two Jewish students on a campus. One is an admirer of the Likud party in Israel, Sharon, Shamir. The other one is an admirer of Shulamit Aloni, the Citizens' Right Party, and thinks there should be an independent Palestinian state. They get into a discussion. And at one point, one of the Jewish students says, you are a self-hating Jew. And the other says, you are a fascist. Should that debate be punished? I mean, the whole thing is totally contrary to free inquiry, to being able... You know, Malcolm X used to be very, very concerned that black youngsters learned to demystify speech, that they could use language so well that they would drive these bigots away just by what they said. To say that they should be cocooned because some terrible speech comes along is to do them a great disservice.
Some people have been calling the college campus speech codes politically correct codes. What do you think?
Oh, the term politically correct, I must say, though I have used it perhaps too often myself, tends, like all of these categories, to be too inclusive and therefore not very useful. I would say in terms of speech codes, while I think a lot of those students who have created the new orthodoxy, which is the left orthodoxy version of what I grew up under in college, where you had to watch out that people didn't call you a simp or communist themselves. In other words, it's now gone from right to left as to who decides what the correct thinking and speech is. Nonetheless, having said that, I think these codes are dangerous enough, dangerous in the long term, because people in college get a mindset that often goes through the rest of their lives, and they're going to learn through these speech codes that it's okay if your motivation is all right to censor people, which I think is a very dangerous long-term idea. But I wouldn't necessarily call it politically correct. It's just wrong.
When did colleges start adapting speech codes?
I'd say it started about 2.5 years ago. It started because there were very real racist, sexist, anti-Semitic incidents on a number of campuses. And instead of trying to figure out what they as educational institutions can do, I mean, for God's sake, if you are running a college and you can't, if you don't know how to change the perspective of a bigoted student so he or she becomes unbigoted, then you're in the wrong business. I can't think of a more stupid, uneducational approach to this very real problem than hundreds of colleges and universities are taking.
What about the idea that it's appropriate for the administrators at a university to say there's a certain kind of intolerance that will not be tolerated on our university campus?
Sure, they ought to say that, and they ought to do something about it. They ought to hold classes and seminars and forums and get people in the community that the college is part of onto the campus and start talking to these kids. But to think that they're going to get anywhere by censoring this kind of language is absurd. And it is not educational. I mean, what do you learn from being expelled? I guess you learn not to do it again, but you can't do it again anyway because you've been expelled.
Nat Hentoff writes a weekly column on First Amendment issues for the Village Voice. More on free speech and language codes after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Several of Nat Hentoff's recent columns were devoted to the case of Brown University. Brown doesn't have a language code, but it does have a code of conduct which prohibits abusive, threatening, or demeaning actions based on race, religion, gender, handicap, ethnicity, national origin, or sexual orientation. One student was recently expelled for his disruptive, drunken behavior, harassing students with anti-Black, anti-Semitic, and anti-homosexual obscenities. Critics of the decision, like Hentoff, say the student was really punished for unsavory language, not for his actions. The director of the Rhode Island ACLU has urged Brown University to change its code of conduct to clarify the distinction between behavior and speech. Vartan Gregorian is the president of Brown University. He upheld the expulsion on appeal. Gregorian says he opposes language codes, but when one student uses racial epithets to harass another student, it crosses the line into behavior the university will not tolerate.
I've defended the rights of Orthodox Jews, Orthodox Catholics, and others to attack homosexuality or attack others. You can counter those because they're discussing issues. But if somebody is coming to harass you, targets you, follows you, phones you, puts notes under your door threatening you, then it's no longer speech, no longer communication. It's harassment.
Let me ask you, you've been at universities for a long time. I know you were at the University of Pennsylvania before Brown. How long were you at the University of Pennsylvania?
10 years almost.
Have you seen the climate change a lot on campus? Do you feel like you're seeing an upswing in that kind of behavior?
Well, nationally, we're a reflection of the nation. Universities are not an oasis, which students think they are. There is upswing nationally, and in times of recession especially, there's all kinds of necessity of scapegoating people. And we see that on our campuses, where people think if we did not have minorities of the United States, maybe our problems would be no problems, we'd be a cohesive nation. And I see that kind of scapegoating now. That's one thing I see. The other thing that is happening, there's a great deal of animosity towards homosexuals. Homosexuality is not something new. It has been with us for thousands of years. But the lifestyles and the ideologies of some people now shock others. What I say to our students, we have Baptists, we have vegetarians, we have homosexuals, we have Orthodox. You don't have to agree with them. You don't have even to respect them. But you have to respect their right on campus to their ideology, to their living quarters, and so forth. You can criticize the ideology. You can criticize their lifestyle, but you cannot harass these people. That's the distinction which somehow currently is disappearing in the national scene.
Do you think that running a university has become more difficult in the past few years?
Yes.
Are there new problems that university administrators face that they didn't face before?
Absolutely. Universities have become small city-states in which presidents have become mayors of those universities, not only chief educational officers, but mayors of those universities. At the same time, I have people from 100 nations, 50 states, hundreds of different religious and other groups, from your vegetarian to the kosher food proponent, and from animal rights all the way to libertarians and from Democrats, conservatives, and others. So it's very hard to run a university because the society has become more complex, and we're working with a corpus of laws, federal and state and others. So it's become a very complex institution, and in which education is role of president as an educator is receding, especially if society is expecting us to do everything good, everything the right way, and not a single mistake, and B, consult everyone, act expeditiously, protect everybody's right, and promote general welfare at the same time without offending anyone.
Vartan Gregorian is the president of Brown University. Ed Chen is a lawyer with the ACLU of Northern California. Chen is Asian. As a free speech activist and a minority, he sympathizes with both sides in the controversy over restricting abusive language. He helped draft guidelines concerning harassment of minority group members. These guidelines are being used by the California chapters of the ACLU.
What it says is that racism and sexism and other forms of discrimination on campus must be fought in the first instance not by censorship, but by policy changes, by integrating the campus community, both in terms of faculty, student body, curriculum. Campus administrators must speak out actively against racism and racist incidents. They can't just sit by and treat those as isolated instances. And they must take affirmative, proactive efforts to deal with racism and other forms of discrimination on campus. The second part of the policy says that in doing so, they may enact codes of conduct which do sanction certain forms of speech or expression. But those codes of conduct must be narrowly drafted. They have to do essentially three things. One, the speech that is being prohibited must be speech which is specifically intended to harass an individual or specific individuals on the basis of sex, race, color, disability, religion, sexual orientation, alienage, or national origin. Second, it has to be directly addressed to the individual as opposed to something that is announced in a newspaper or distributed campus-wide. Third, it's got to be serious enough so it actually creates a hostile and intimidating environment which impedes the educational opportunity of the victim. And then finally, we require that certain due process concerns be met, that there be, for instance, illustrations in the codes of the kinds of examples which are punishable and which are not punishable, that due process hearing rights are afforded to the student who is accused, and that the punishment be proportionate to the gravity of the violation.
Can you explain to me what the difference is between somebody who says terribly racist things about, you know, blacks or Jews or women at a rally, and it's addressed to no one in particular, but to the whole gender or the whole race? The difference between that and someone who particularly says something very misogynist to me, or something, you know, very racist to a black student?
Well, the main difference is that when you have a speech in a public forum, as offensive as it may be, that is the kind of speech that really is the epitome of expression protected by the First Amendment. And whether that be a racist or a sexist message, it is one that is protected. It is like the right of the Nazis to march in Skokie, in front of the Skokie Village Town Hall. When you begin to direct a racist epithet towards an individual, I think you begin to lose the First Amendment value. You're not trying to persuade society and the public of your particular political views. At some point, your sole intent really is to inflict injury, psychological, emotional injury upon a victim. And I think that deserves very little First Amendment protection.
Your guidelines also say that to be punished, a student would have to not only use, you know, racial or misogynist language directed at one person in particular, but they'd have to create a hostile, intimidating environment that would, you know, adversely affect the educational environment for the person who's the subject of these epithets. How would you measure whether it's creating a hostile, intimidating environment or not?
Well, admittedly, that is not a simple element to apply. That element was actually borrowed from federal law which prohibits sexual and racial harassment in the workplace. The point of that, in our requiring that as an element, is that there was concern that a single epithet, for instance, in a particular context, may not be enough to actually punish or expel a student. It may be that you have to look at the circumstances. If it's repeated, for instance, that is more likely to be punishable than if it's just a one-time incident.
Why shouldn't administrators and college students just say to people who are the subjects of these racial epithets that, well, that's the price of living in a democracy. Free speech is protected. You know, no one's allowed to hurt you, but in the world, people say ugly things, and, you know, you fight speech with more speech.
Well, you know, often people say that that the response to sort of offensive speech is either to ignore it or respond with other speech. But I think the first step in this analysis has to be to understand the nature of racist harassment or sexist harassment or other types of class-based harassment. There's a difference between, for instance, being called a jerk or an asshole and being called a Chinaman or a nigger. Those words sort of reflect hundreds of years of societal defamation. And to simply stand by and say, well, you're just going to have to defend yourself, I think is a fairly insensitive response. And I think if we're concerned about increasing enrollment of minority students, I think it's something that has to be addressed.
Did you get a lot of flack from other branches of the ACLU for coming up with these guidelines?
We got a lot of flack from everywhere, including sort of internally within the ACLU as well as from externally from the press. I think any attempt to allow some limitation on speech is going to attract a lot of attention, particularly when it is an ACLU organization that is contemplating that kind of policy.
Ed Chen is staff counsel with the ACLU of Northern California. A few points of view on an ongoing debate. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.